Tonight on the Daily Debrief, police didn't notice it at first, but is this blood on the table of a California family found dead in the desert? Plus, DNA that doesn't make sense in the case of a New Jersey man accused of murdering his wife as his son watched. And an update in the case of a Wisconsin man accused of kidnapping Jamie Claus after killing her parents. That's straight ahead on the Daily Debrief for Tuesday, January 15th. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Debrief. We have three cases we'll be discussing tonight, so let's begin with the McStay family murders in California. Defendant Charles Merritt faces a possible death sentence if convicted in the killings of business associate Joseph McStay, McStay's wife, and their two sons. At first, the authorities wondered if the family had gone to Mexico to avoid business debts, but suspicions eventually focused on the defendant. Prosecutors say he killed the family, dumped their car near the border, and then dumped their bodies in two graves in the desert. Merritt's DNA is on the steering wheel and gear shift of the McStay family vehicle, but the defense says that's because Merritt and McStay shook hands at a restaurant before the family disappeared. Last night, a detective who entered the McStay home testified that he didn't notice it at the time, but enlarged photos might suggest that there were droplets of possible blood on the missing family's table.
You, in your career as a police detective, seen blood spatter?
I have.
Okay. So what you see in the bottom part of this photograph, you can't say it's blood, right?
I can't say it's blood. It's a horrible moment where I don't know what it is. I did not see it with my naked eyes when I was in the residence at all. And now that the district attorney zoomed it in, it puts a pit in my stomach, but I don't know what it is. I can't say it's blood, and I can't say it isn't blood.
Does blood dry in a specific pattern?
It does.
How does it dry?
Actually, no foundation.
Sustained lay foundation.
You received training as to how blood spatter or blood will dry.
I went to a 40-hour course by the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department for blood pattern analysis.
And does blood dry in a specific manner?
Yes.
How?
It traditionally, obviously, dries at the where it's the thinnest on an object. If it's blood that's spattered onto an object, the outside or the thinnest edges are going to dry first, and then the thicker or the raised area is going to dry later. And in this, what you see is skeletonized. We call it skeletonized drop of something.
Well, more than one drop.
A lot of drops.
And you said you didn't see it with the naked eye?
No.
And there are reasons for that, right?
Yes, I don't like to make excuses, but there are reasons.
What are some of them?
The reasons for not seeing this with the naked eye, what you're seeing, even in this photo where it's not zoomed in, you're seeing the table, and it is highly illuminated right here. There's a reason for that illumination, and it's called a flash.
So, is it blood? Is it not blood? We just don't know. Court ended early today after cross-examination of that witness about whether the investigation was thorough enough. Also yesterday, a friend of the victims testified that he was helping with a remodeling project and that there was animosity between victim Summer McStay and the defendant.
Who all was at the house on the 31st with you while you painted these two walls?
Summer, Joey, the two boys, and Chase.
Do you see Chase in the courtroom today?
Yes, I do.
Please identify him for the record by telling us where he's seated and an article of clothing he's wearing.
To my left, purple tie, blue shirt.
May the record reflect the witnesses identified the defendant. Was the defendant there the whole time?
No, he wasn't.
When do you remember him showing up?
He was there when I first got there.
And what was he doing there? Do you know?
He was kind of standing there as I walked in. I could feel the tension in the room between Summer and he. And right off the bat, I knew this is who Summer was talking about. She didn't introduce me. He didn't introduce himself. And she just kind of avoided him. And so I'm like, this must be the guy. Joy was in the office, maybe on the phone or the computer. So I think he was waiting for Joseph, and then the kids were running around, obviously, coming to greet me, they knew me, and, just me out.
That same witness said clothes were strewn about the house after the family disappeared. He said they were messy, but not quite that messy, and that the clothes struck him as odd. On cross-examination, the defense asked about Dan Kavanaugh, the man who the defense is trying to convince jurors is an alternate suspect.
You described Dan in your interviews as he's kind of an irresponsible person?
Correct.
And you when Joseph was working with Dan, you learned that obviously Joseph was paying Dan.
Correct.
And your understanding that Dan was very dependent on the money from Joseph?
I think
objection
so.
Calls for speculation. Move to strike.
If there was an answer to the last question, instructing the jury is instructed to disregard the last answer if there was
one. And when you were speaking with Joseph on the 3rd in the office, you were talking about the business and his relationship and working relationship with Dan, correct?
Correct.
And you knew Dan to be a loose cannon?
Yeah, a little bit from Joseph.
And you would always ask Joseph, how's it going working with Dan? Because you knew how Dan was.
I knew that Joseph...
Objection, Your Honor. Violates motion in limine. Character evidence.
Earlier on in the case, the mother of victim Joseph McSay testified about entering the missing family's home. The judge said we could not show her on camera.
It was a rotten smell. Mildew. Dirty diapers, maggots, it just smells.
Did you go into the kitchen at all?
Yes.
And when you went into the kitchen, can you describe what you saw?
There was food out and about, and the coffee pot had mildew in it, and the smell. It was, you know, dishes not washed, messy. There's still some cabinets on the floor because they were repainting.
What did you do as a result of walking into the house and smelling that odor and things like that, seeing dirty dishes? What did you do?
I asked Mr. DeGaulle if I could clean this up some because the smell was so bad.
Did you clean up some that day?
Yes, I did. I did clean up some.
What did you clean up?
The kitchen, the coffee pot, and emptied the trash cans for the diapers.
Did you dust the house?
No.
Did you sweep the floors?
No.
A police officer testified that he entered the family home and sensed something bad had happened.
Did you see any obvious signs of blood, tissue, dead bodies, anything like that?
No, sir.
What else would you look for?
Blood on the walls, door jams, broken glass, maybe broken windows. Things that would normally be what you might believe to be out of place. Maybe something near the front door, like as they're getting dragged out, something just to that effect.
You didn't see any of those things?
No, sir.
But you called homicide?
Yes, sir.
So if this was not normal, why'd you call homicide?
For several reasons. One, when we did go in, it appeared that there was plates of food that were half eaten and just left, and they weren't picked up or moved. People who have families, normally after they're done eating, will at least take their dishes to the sink or counter, or somebody will pick them up. It's a missing family of four, which is not something that's reported on a daily basis, which strikes to have a little concern as far as, maybe something is going on.
A neighbor testified about home security images from the area where the McStays lived. Prosecutors think an image from February 3rd might be the McStay family vehicle. They think another image from the next day might show the defendant's truck passing through the neighborhood. Traffic in the area is rare because the McStays lived on a cul-de-sac. The defense says the height of the taillights does not match up with those on the defendant's truck. One issue in this case was this mention of the defendant's criminal record.
A record.
The defendant told you he didn't want to go in that house because he had a prior record.
Leading.
Overruled.
He had had some trouble with the law, and he didn't want to go in. I don't remember the exact wording, but
That's what the defendant told you?
If I said that, I remember it way better back then.
Okay. The defendant told you something along those lines of why he didn't want to go in the house.
Yes.
Attorney Andrew Cherkosky is with me here on the Daily Debrief tonight. So, Andrew, let's go back to this so-called blood on the table. Should jurors even be hearing about this if it wasn't properly tested and we don't really know what it is?
Well, I think it likely was a tough call for the judge to let it in any regard. I'm almost surprised that he did, given that we don't have some sort of corroboration, and it seems very speculative. In a day and age where we use DNA so frequently, to not have a DNA swab or even some sort of confirmation that it is blood, it's probably not going to be very probative to a jury, even though they've heard it.
Yeah, if the state has the burden to prove that it was indeed blood and the crime happened in the house, then should this, in a just and equitable world, blow up the state's case in the state's face?
Well, we see here that there's these potential blood spatters, but it doesn't tell much of a story. So it is a bold move for the prosecution to take a little bit of blood spatter, even if that were what it is, and try to extrapolate a case to prove what happened in that house. It's not particularly consistent with what we know so far.
And again, we're still early on in this case. It's possible that the case could tighten up as the state moves along. Andrew, we will check in again with you at the end of the broadcast. Still ahead tonight here on the Daily Debrief, an upcoming trial where a woman is accused of murdering her military husband, sending his money to Brazil, and then fleeing there herself. Plus, the defense scores a couple of points involving DNA test results in the trial of a man accused of stabbing his wife to death right in front of their son. We will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. A judge has set a $5 million bail for the Wisconsin man accused of kidnapping Jamie Kloss after authorities say he killed her parents. Jake Patterson appeared in court yesterday to answer those charges. According to court documents, Patterson confessed several times. He's due back in court February 6th for a preliminary hearing. That is where the judge decides if there's enough evidence to send him to trial. Opening statements are scheduled tomorrow in the trial of a woman accused of murdering her military husband. Claudia Herrick faces charges in Ohio over the death of Air Force Reserve Major Carl Herrick. Claudia is accused of draining Carl's bank accounts, sending his money to her relatives overseas, and practicing at a shooting range before pulling the trigger and killing him. Authorities say she then fled to her native Brazil, where the money was. Brazil's constitution prevented her extradition, so it took threats by the U.S. Congress to stop processing Brazilian visas to get the government of Brazil to rescind Claudia's citizenship. That's how she wound up back in America for trial. You can watch the case tomorrow on the Law and Crime Network. I'll have a recap here on The Debrief. Now to the New Jersey case where a 12-year-old at the time says he watched his father murder his mother. Defendant Jeremiah Monell faces a series of charges, including first-degree murder, over the death of his wife, Tara O'Shea Watson. Prosecutors say he stabbed her more than 40 times before dumping the knives behind their kitchen stove, rather. Monell fled and led police on a manhunt for 2 weeks. The maximum penalty for Monell, if convicted, is life without parole. A DNA analyst placed the defendant's DNA all over the crime scene along with the victims, and that's not a surprise because they lived in the home together. But the defense did bring up some key points about unknown DNA and the lack of the defendant's DNA on the knives believed to be the murder weapons.
Jeremiah Monell is identified as the source of the DNA profile obtained from specimen number 23, which was a partially burnt cigarette.
But he was excluded from specimen number 22. Is that correct?
Yes, both Tara L. O'Shea Watson and Jeremiah Monell were excluded from 22 and 24.
And what were they?
22 and 24 were both partially burnt cigarettes.
So just to clarify, that means that neither one of them were the contributors from those cigarettes, correct?
That's correct.
What was 30-1 and 30-2?
30-1 was knife swabbing from the blade, and 30-2 was knife swabbing from the handle.
Was Jeremiah Monell the source of any of the DNA contributors from that handle or that blade?
No, Tara L. O'Shea Watson was identified as the source of both of those samples.
I also noted on your thing that says that you submitted sample specimens 22, 23, and 24 into CODIS. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And why would you do that?
Those we would be submitting to that database to identify possible contributors to those samples.
And in this particular case, did this submitting samples, did it return any results?
Not to my knowledge.
A neighbor and friend testified about what happened the night before the crime and how she learned about what happened.
Do you recall hearing anything later that night that caught your attention?
It was around like 11:30. I thought I heard his truck fire up and he sounded like he left, but I wasn't awake.
What time did you get up the next morning?
Around 8. It's normally when my alarm would go off and my alarm woke me up. I wasn't quite out of bed yet, but there was pounding on my door, and I didn't know who it was because Tara had a key to my house, so she would just walk in.
Normally, what time would Tara get to your house?
Normally around a little, about 8:15, 8:30, around in there.
Okay, about what time did you hear that pounding?
A little before 8:15. It was pretty early yet.
So once you heard that pounding, what did you do?
I answered the door.
And who was at the door?
Little Maya and, Jeremiah Jr. and Sarah. He was in jeans and a shirt. Sarah was in jammies. It was unusual because Tara was always with them. So I asked Jeremiah, where's mommy? And she...
Objection. No problem.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
So Jeremiah said something to you?
Yes.
What was your reaction to that?
I was in shock.
And what did you do after hearing his response?
I went to my room, got dressed, put a pair of slippers on, and I went to Tara's house.
We know from the son's testimony that he told his neighbor that his mother was dead. The neighbor said the son appeared shocked, but she still struggled to believe it. From here, though, the neighbor picks up the story as she arrived at the Monell house along with her own husband.
I went in. As soon as you walk into her home, through the back door is her bedroom, and then there's the hallway. So I walked up the hallway, closed the bathroom door because it was open and it would block the hallway. And then I closed that and went through the curtain that was hanging and into the kitchen and then into the living room.
And what did you see once you got into the living room?
Frozen blanket on the floor with a body underneath.
Did you recognize the blanket?
Yes.
What did you recognize that blanket from?
It was Sarah's favorite blanket, and Tara used to curl up on the couch with it.
And what was your reaction to seeing that blanket on the floor?
Shock. I didn't believe it. I didn't touch anything, so I just went and opened the front door and went out. I went outside to get some air because I knew she was gone. There was no movement. And I just stayed outside when my husband was in the house on the phone with 911.
The neighbor's testimony dovetails with that of Jeremiah Monell Jr., who said he witnessed the attack and ran for help in the morning. The judge asked us to blur his face.
I heard a huge thump, and I crawled over to my curtain to peek, and I saw my mother on the floor and my father standing above her.
Do you remember hearing anything after that thump?
Yes, my mother screamed in pain because she had a back problem, and she said, ow, and that's...
And what was your dad doing?
He then jumped on her and started choking her.
How long do you think your dad was choking your mom?
A minute, maybe less. He got up, and he got a knife off the fridge, a kitchen knife.
After he got up, did you hear your mom say anything?
Yes. She said, let me die in peace.
And where did your dad go after after your mom said that?
To the kitchen to grab a knife off the fridge.
Did you actually see your dad grab the knife?
No, but I did hear the metal of the knife rub on the wood, or the plastic, I mean. He went back to my mother and stabbed her.
Did you see anything in your dad's hands while he walked back to
the room? Yes.
What did you see?
A knife. He stabbed my mother. I looked away.
Did you hear anything?
Just the gushing of him stabbing.
After you looked away, what did you do?
I climbed in my bed.
And what did you do after you climbed in your bed?
I went under my blanket and started crying.
Andrew Shirkosky, let me ask your opinion on this one. So the son says he witnessed the attack, but he was cross-examined about a previous statement that suggests that something might have blocked his view of at least some of it. Couple that with this lack of the defendant's DNA on the knife, and do we have a possibility of an acquittal here despite the majority of the son's testimony?
Well, I don't think so. I think that this is a very strong case for the prosecution. There's always a possibility. The defense starts with the idea that it was someone else. They don't suggest who that might be, not that they have to, but there is not evidence in this case that has been presented thus far suggesting that it could have been someone else. And we have such credible evidence from the son that it was his father. It's a very difficult case for the defense here.
I would agree as well. But this lack of the DNA on the handles of the knife, that really struck me as a bit bizarre, because not only is this his home, but the son indicates that this was a vicious attack, and apparently 40 plus stab wounds. One would think that if the defendant were hanging on to the knife, then he would leave some DNA behind.
Very suspicious. I agree. That's when I heard that testimony, I'm scratching my head thinking through all of the DNA testimony I've heard over so many years, trying to figure out how that could be. It's an issue in this case for the prosecution.
I agree. I want to thank you for joining me, Andrew Shirkosky. Thanks again for being on The Debrief tonight.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Live trial coverage begins on the Law and Crime Network at 9 o'clock Eastern. I will see you back here on The Debrief and an earlier time from 4 o'clock to 4:30 Eastern with our recap of the day's legal news. That will fit in the break of the McStay case. Have a good evening, folks. I'll see you tomorrow.